Good morning. I invite you to be opening your Bibles this morning. Book of Genesis, chapter 12. Genesis 12. I'm going to read from there to get started in just a minute. Genesis chapter 12. I will tell you right now this morning, there will be nothing on the screen. I had made some slides for this morning, but then the internet ate them. And we were looking for them on the computer. I put them there. I know I did, but they are gone. So I'm going to have to preach the old-fashioned way this morning with words. I'm going to have to listen. And that's awkward for all of us. I'm as scared as you are. I know I sometimes have parents tell me, that the PowerPoint helps their kids take notes and stuff like that. And I remember those days. I remember when I was a kid, my favorite preachers growing up were the guys who used the overhead projector. And the younger people have no idea what that is. You'll find them next to the VCRs, kids. Have to clear that right up. Genesis 12, beginning in verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, and I will make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." Those may well be some of the most important words in all of the Bible. They are the words with which God in earnest begins the great project of saving the human race. It is through Abraham that the Messiah would come. It is the great nation that God promised Abraham that is actually the church. It's not the Israel of the flesh, but it is the church. It is us who are, as Paul makes clear in the book of Galatians, it is us who are really the children of Abraham. His descendants without numbering, like the stars of the sky or the sand of the seashore. It's us. These words to Abram at that point in the story, start the great project by which God saves the human race. Abraham as a man, of course, is a compelling figure. His story casts a shadow over the rest of the Bible. It's not just the promises that God makes to Abraham that matter. It's the man himself. He becomes the great type. He becomes the great image of the human being of faith before God. He is the man of whom the prophets referred to as the friend of God. He is the man whom Jesus spoke highly of. He is the person that Paul used as an example for Christians. He is the man who James used as an example for Christians. He is the man of whom the Hebrew writer wrote approvingly as an example and as a lesson for Christians. He is a man whose shadow stands and pervades across all the pages of the book upon whom our lives depend. And to him was given a promise upon which all of human history and human hope depend. And so we called Abraham to leave his country, to leave his relatives, to leave his father's house, and to go forth. Abraham's story is a compelling one because on the one level, here's a man who appeared to have everything. He was rich, he was accomplished, he was powerful. He had his own private army. That's impressive. But he was missing what culturally may have been the most important of things. He was missing children. In particular, he was missing a son, an heir, somebody to continue on his family name and his lineage. Indeed, his very name, Abram, later Abraham, meant father or exalted father. And then when God changed his name to Abraham, father of a nation, how difficult and awkward that name must have been. And so God comes to a man who on the surface, especially by our culture standards, seems to have so much, but in reality understood he had nothing because he had no son. And God makes him a promise, despite your name, despite your circumstances, despite your age, I'm going to give you that for which you long. Not just a name, but a name through a seed, through a nation, that it will go on. But to do this, to keep your name going, to keep your blessing going, to make your name great, you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to go. I'm not going to tell you where you're going yet. No GPS coordinates, no Google Maps, no Waze app. I just need you to get going. I'll tell you when you get there. And so Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, really actually back a couple verses at the end of chapter 11, Abraham begins a journey that comes to its climax in Genesis 22. after Genesis 20, there'll be a couple more pages of Abraham's life, but in the very real sense, Abraham's life, the way the story is told, really comes to its climax in Genesis 22, a story we well know, where by the time we get to Genesis chapter 22, Abram finally has that miraculous child of promise. We know his name as Isaac. And you remember the story in Genesis chapter 22, beginning in verse 1, where God comes to Abraham, after these things. And God, the text says, tests Abraham. And God says to him, Abraham, and Abraham says, here am I. And he says to him, take now your son, your only son, whom you love. In case you know who that is, that's Isaac. And go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. I will tell you, this story is meant to bookend what we read about in Genesis chapter 12. Go to the land of which I will show you. Now let's go to the mountain I will show you. Get up and go, Abram. The story has come full circle. Now he has a name. Now he has a son. The possibility of becoming a great nation seems possible, maybe even probable. But now he's told to continue on the journey that he's been on all along. Now it's not go to a land. Now it's go to a mountain of which I will show you. Echoes of the past that will determine Abraham's future. And take that son, the only one you've got, whom you love, and offer him as a burnt offering. So Abram rose early in the morning, because that's what Abram does. That's what he's been doing since chapter 12, going where God tells him to do so that he can do what God asks of him. And so Abram rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. He splint wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And on the third day, Abram raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And Abram said to the young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the lad will go there, and we will worship, and we will return to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. And so the two of them walked on together, and Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And Abraham said, here am I, my son. He said, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said to him, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And so the two of them walked on together. And then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood, bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and he took the ram, and he offered up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and you have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And so Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and they went together to Beersheba, and there Abraham lived. The story takes place decades after Abraham has started his journey back in Genesis 11 and Genesis chapter 12. Decades afterwards. All that's been invested by Abram in God's journey to this point. So you think about it. I mean, it begins with he took Lot, the orphan son of his dead brother. And it may well be that part of why he took Lot with him on the journey to begin with was perhaps Lot was once viewed as the potential heir, the potential adopted son for Abraham, who had no son of his own, and his brother was dead, Lot's father being Abraham's brother. He's dead. By Genesis 15, Abraham says to God, well, now it's Eliezer of Damascus. He's my heir. What's going to happen, God? I'm on this journey. I'm doing what you say, and I have no son. Eventually, they try with Abraham and Hagar. It was Sarah's idea. Abraham goes along, and then we have Ishmael. And God says, no, that's not going to work either. He's not the one. Until finally, now you have Isaac. And now years have been invested by Isaac. He's called a lad. He's called a young man. But he would have been plenty old enough to talk, to reason, to understand. Years have been invested in Isaac's growth and Isaac's maturity. And for years, perhaps, Abraham has gotten comfort and gotten comfortable with the fact that God is keeping his promises. Because here is Isaac. None of the others have worked out. God has kept his promise from not just me, but from Sarah as well, has come this son. And therefore, the story gets all the more poignant when God says, now I want you to take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you loved. I want you to offer him. It gets all the more poignant because, as Paul so delicately puts it in Romans chapter 4, if Abraham and Sarah were way too old to be having kids when Isaac was born, that's why it was a miracle. Hoping against hope, Paul talks about, because they are past all reasonable age and expectation for having children of their own, biologically speaking. If they were too old when Isaac was born, you know they're too old now to start over again with another son from barren Sarah, old Sarah, and old Abraham. And so the story goes on. And it's excruciating in its detail, the days of the journey, the few people in the traveling party, the vivid detail of item by item that Abraham picks up to go up the mountain when they get there, including the knife. The awkward question that Isaac asks, Dad, we've got the wood, we've got the fire, where's the sacrifice? What would you say to your son? What would you say to your child? How would you feel in that moment? The text intentionally echoes the journey that Abraham's been on. I want you to go to the mountain I will show you, just like Abraham has gone to the land that God has shown him. And now Abraham has to make a choice. And that's impressive. The text makes clear that God is testing Abraham, not because God doesn't know what will happen, but because this is the way that God draws out of us, for ourselves and before all of heaven's eyes, the angels, and people of faith like us centuries later and millennia later, pulls out what God knows is in a person, whether it's rebellion or whether it's faithfulness. He tests Abraham, not because he doesn't know, but that it's so Abraham can know. Abraham can know about himself, and Abraham can even more so know about the God whom he follows. And in so doing, we ourselves can see what this man is really made of. But in verse 2, it's interesting how it's written in Hebrew, in which God says, New American Standard puts it, take now your son. In Hebrew, it's an imperative, but it's a gentle type of imperative. Please take your son. I want you to do this, you need to do this, you have to do this, but please do it. There's a gentleness to the way that God takes it, as though God himself is acknowledging by way of concession the enormity of what he's told Abraham he must now do. And so Abraham doesn't hesitate. Abraham gets up in the morning and he goes. And he goes up the mountain, and he takes the wood, and he takes the fire, he takes the knife, and he takes his son. The Hebrew writer, I think as many of us are well aware in Hebrews chapter 11, when the Hebrew writer appeals to this aspect of Abraham's story, of Abraham's life, of Abraham's journey, which the way this story is cleverly tells, reminds us the journey wasn't over once he got to the land. The journey is his entire life before his God. The Hebrew writer makes clear that Abraham, as he was going through this, being tested in verse 17 of Hebrews 11, offered up Isaac, a statement for which commentators have long noted the fact that in heart and intention, if not in actual literal action, Abraham had done the deed, being stayed by God's own voice at the last possible moment as the knife was lifted. Abraham had de facto offered Isaac, the son whom he had received through the promises as his only begotten son. And the Hebrew writer understands the enormity of what's on the line here. In Isaac, your descendants shall be called. And see, what the Hebrew writer's remembering and what we see back in Genesis is that it's not just the parental angle that's at stake here when God tells Abraham to offer Isaac. That's what we focus on because none of us can imagine the heartache, the pain, the struggle to do something like this with one of our own children. But that's not just what's at stake here. If you go back a page to Genesis chapter 21 in the story, something the Hebrew writer is well aware and brings out here. Back in Genesis 21, God made very clear to Abraham. In verse 12 of 21, God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and the maid." In other words, of Ishmael and Hagar. "Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. For through Isaac, your descendants will be named." Through Isaac, your descendants will be named. God's already said that to Abraham when he tells him to take a walk and go to the mountain I will show you and offer your son there. In other words, not only is there the heartache of the parental dimension to this story, but God has in no unambiguous way told Abraham, everything that I promise you, everything that you've hoped in, everything that you've lived for, everything that you've sacrificed for, everything hangs upon Isaac having children. It's going to be Isaac through whom your descendants are going to come. And now God says to Abraham, not only do I want you to sacrifice your son, your only son, the son you love, but I want you to sacrifice the one who once upon a time I told you is going to be the key to everything else I've offered you, the great name, the nation, the blessings. Now go kill him. Because I said so. In other words, if Isaac dies, it's not just Abraham's beloved son dies. It's the very promises that Abraham has lived for go with him. Everything Abraham has sacrificed for, the years living in tents, bargaining with the natives of the land for water and pasture, and eventually even a place to bury his dead. All of it for nothing if Isaac goes, because God's told him that Isaac is the key. But now Isaac's supposed to die. And the Hebrew writer understands that. Abraham offers his son, offers the son of whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants will be called." He offers that son. Because Abraham is willing to obey God even when it makes no sense. Because you understand the logic problem that Abraham now has. Isaac is the one through whom my descendants that God has promised me will come, but now I'm supposed to put Isaac to death. So how is God going to keep his promises to me if I do what God says? How is God going to work this out? How is God going to do what he has promised me if I do what he says? How will God ever square this circle? But Abraham also understands that it's not in one sense his problem to have the understanding, let alone the power, to figure this out. His job is just simply to obey. And so he does, and so he goes. And the Hebrew writer, verse 19, makes clear that part of what he's thinking about is that God's able to raise people from the dead. He's able to raise people back from the dead. So if God, you know, I bet this God whom I'm following, I'm sure that this God I'm following, who's giving me life from death already, when he gave an old man and a barren old woman a son to begin with, I bet this God who knows something about giving life in the first place has a way of bringing back life if that's what he chooses to do. And while the Hebrew writer is channeling, is by inspiration explaining Abraham's thought of mind, there's nowhere in the text of Genesis that Abraham ever puts it quite that way, that God's going to, I don't know, Isaac, what he's going to do. He'll probably just bring you back to life, my son. I don't know. And the Genesis story's never put that way. Maybe, just maybe, I don't know, but maybe where the Hebrew writer got this, aside from inspiration itself, but where it lies in the story is when Abraham says to the young men who were carrying the things and journeying with them, that we will come back to you. We will worship and we will come back. In that immense statement, Abraham is anticipating God's solution. And so Abraham is prepared to trust God to do all that God has said, even though what God is asking him to do makes no sense at all, even in terms of how God's going to keep his own promises to Abraham, because it's going to be through Isaac God had clearly told him. And so there it is, the story of Abraham, as the great man of faith who becomes the friend of God, who, as though everything else in this story isn't enough, in that moment shows the life that he lives before God is truly one of obedience and trust, not of clear vision, certain understanding, are the things that we typically want and that we typically demand and ask for of God before we will obey. For God, it's all about faith. This is what God is looking for, and this is what God wants to show us, show the world for all time, all places, all generations. This is the type of man who gets the blessing. This is the type of person that I am looking for. This is what God wanted then. This is still what God wants today. A trust that obeys, no matter what God asks, or no matter how contradictory even sometimes it seems, God is telling us. Do you trust God enough to do what he says? Abraham proved he was that kind of a man. Abraham proved he was that kind of a person. And so the Hebrew writer, in words that we well know in James chapter 2, says, or reminds us, that even the demons believe in God. They tremble before that fact. They know there's a God. They're plenty convinced of his power. But that understanding is not the kind of faith that saves, the kind of faith that God looks for. Abraham is the opposite. Abraham, James says in 2 and verse 21, was justified by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar. You see, James says, that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected, it was completed. That's the point of the test. It was perfected or completed. It was drawn out and shown to be a mature and substantive thing that now all of us can look and see from the outside what God could see on the inside in that man. And so the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. When the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6 says that without faith it is impossible to please God. Without faith it is impossible to please God. What the Hebrew writer is getting at there, and we need to understand this and understand this well, is not just a belief and intellectual acceptance of certain facts as being true. Jesus is the Son of God and so forth. What the Hebrew writer means, if you look at the context of that statement, that without faith it is impossible to please him. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. But what the Hebrew is getting at is that without trust, without a loyal trust that motivates us to obey God, it's impossible to please him. Because that's from where the Hebrew writer goes on to tell those stories about great people of faith, whether it's Abel, whether it's Noah, whether it's Abraham. People who did the odd, the strange, the mysterious, the incomprehensible, simply because they trusted God enough and trusted in God's promises about a great future if we will follow him. They trusted him enough to do what he says. And so we need to understand that God is looking for obedience no matter what he says. That's what he wants. That's what the mark of true faith is. That's what God was testing and teasing out of Abraham so that all of us could see it. What God does not want is mere mental acknowledgement that there is a God, he exists, he's big, he's powerful, he's told us some things. He doesn't want merely mental acknowledgement. He doesn't want just happy talk and happy thinking either, which sometimes passes for a superficial and shallow form of faith. The book of Hebrews chapter 11 goes on towards the end of it to make very clear that sometimes faithful people die. Sometimes faithful people suffer. Faith is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. Faith is not just happy talk. Sometimes others were tortured. Sometimes some were scourged. Sometimes some were in prison. Sometimes some were stoned. Sometimes some were sawn in two. Sometimes some were put to death in the sword. Sometimes some were exiled. Sometimes some faithful people were sent about in sheepskins, goatskins, destitute, poorly treated. Sometimes some faithful people had to wander in deserts and mountains, caves and holes in the ground. But they did it because they were faithful, because they trusted God, even in the wilderness, even in the pain, even in the destitution, even in the injustice. They trusted God. They did the right thing no matter what. God said that his way would bring blessing. It didn't look like it, not in this life sometimes, but they trusted him just like Abraham did, that the promise in Isaac, your descendants will be called, it's going to happen even if I sacrifice him today on this mountain. It'll happen. Because I trust my God. So God doesn't want merely mental acknowledgement. He doesn't want just happy thoughts and happy talk. He certainly doesn't want self-imposed tests of faith that we sometimes do, where we sit there and we say, you know what, I'm going to live recklessly. I'm going to live on the edge because I have faith that God can fix anything, even my mistakes, even my failures and my and my falling. So I'll just live on the edge because you know what? There's grace for that. That's what faith is for, that God will forgive even if I mess up. And so I can just live riskily or carelessly. That's not what God's looking for either. What he's looking for, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the day, what he's looking for is faithful people who will make the journey and who will offer the sacrifice. He's looking for faithful people who will make the journey and will offer the sacrifice. What about you? What about me? Are we people who trust in God enough to do what he says, even though it makes no sense, even though we don't understand, even though we don't know where we're going, even though we don't know how our life will end, even though we don't know if we're faithful in what he asks, how our marriage plans will end if we're young, and will not able to work out in this relationship, how it will affect our careers, and how we'll make a living if we're older and deeper into life, how it will work out in my family, or in my friends, or in my community, or in my social groups, if I do what's right, if I follow God. Can you make the journey? Will you offer the sacrifice? See, later on in the story, when Abraham's descendants in the flesh had indeed come through Isaac, and had multiplied greatly and had become a great nation, God called them out to another mountain. And there he told them the Abraham principle in these words, back in Exodus chapter 20. He said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. See, that's what the Abrahamic faith looks like for them and there and then. That's what it still looks like for us. No other gods before me. No other thing. No other value. Nothing else comes before me if you're going to make this journey and see it through to the end and inherit the blessing. Can you make the journey and offer the sacrifice? Can you do what Jesus said to the rich young ruler in Luke chapter 18? Sell all that you possess, give to the poor, you'll have treasure in heaven, follow me. Can we quit pursuing as the priority the material comfort, the money? Can we quit keeping score by the way the world keeps score? Measuring our success in dollars and cents. Can we make the journey and offer the sacrifice when Jesus says, if you love your family more than me, you're not worthy of me in Matthew chapter 10? Will we do what's right? Will we be faithful witnesses? Will we speak the truth and do what's right? Even what makes it hard or difficult or awkward within our family or our extended family. Because he, Jesus says, who loves husband or wife, father or mother, son or daughter more than me, is not worthy of me. Can you put your money on the altar? Can you put your family on the altar? Can you put your very life itself on the altar? For as Jesus puts it in Luke 14 and verse 26, if anyone comes to me, not only hating his father and mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, but yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Because Jesus in the Gospels goes on to talk about those who are willing to sacrifice such things will receive back manyfold more, not just in this life, but in the life to come. Kind of like the promises of God to Abraham. Abraham, if you'll lose it all now, I'll reward you richly later. Just trust me. You and I, ladies and gentlemen, are called to live Abraham's life. That's always held out as an example. That's why he was tested, not just for his benefit, but for ours. To show us that this is what the life that pleases God looks like. That we put whatever it is, whatever our hope is, whatever our comfort is, that we put it on the altar. Trusting in God that no matter how impossible it seems, no matter how far off it may feel, that the day will come when God will give us the blessing. God will deliver what he has promised. And God will take care of us to the end. To have the faith of Abraham, we have to learn to walk in the sacrifice like Abraham. Jesus teases out the implications of this in so many places in the Gospels. The extensive teaching of Jesus is that there can be no second place, no rivalry in our devotion to Him, to God, to the kingdom. So I ask you this morning, as I ask myself, what is it in your life and in mine that we just can't do without? That comes before, that is testing us in the eyes of God and in the struggle of our own heart. What is it? Is it a job? Is it educational attainments and respect? Is it pleasure? Is it enjoyment? Is it money? Is it prosperity? Is it a spouse or the desire for one? Is it children and their earthly academic or athletic success? Is it the quest for reputation? Is it some sort of overt or subtle or abstract value or desire? What is it that rivals God's supremacy in your life and in mine this morning? Because God will not settle for second place, and God does not want to be served simply for the rewards and the blessings. He wants to be served out of faith, trust, loyalty. And that is the journey that Abraham went on. That merely started when he said, "Go to a land I will show you." And came to a climax decades later when he had the son who was the down payment and was then told to sacrifice even that son, even that hope, even the one whom through whom God said, "It's not Ishmael, it's not anybody else, it's not Eliezer, it's Isaac, I'm going to do this for you, but now I want you to sacrifice him." And Abraham went to the mountain God showed him. And Abraham offered. And at the end of the day, what it all comes down to is twice in that story, if you go back and you look at it, Abraham answers correctly. When Isaac says to him, alluded to this a little bit earlier, when Isaac says to him, "Where's the sacrifice?" What would you say? What would I say? Go back and look at what Abraham said. "My son, the Lord will provide." So at the end of the story, it is now said it will be provided in the mountain of God. The Lord provides. He always does. Abraham understood that. Abraham lived in light of that. Doesn't mean Abraham always knew how. That's God's business, not ours. But Abraham understood the way you live in faith is by believing that God will provide. Don't know how, don't know when, but He'll do it. And so what about you this morning? Are you ready? Are you needing to live a life like Abraham's? Are you ready to give your life to God? Are you ready to quit living in the world, living for yourself, living for the momentary pleasures and passions of this age? Are you ready to leave everything and go to where God has shown you? A place in one sense that we still don't completely even really know. The Bible calls it heaven. The Bible calls it the new heavens and the new earth, but it never clearly tells exactly what it's going to be, but we'll know it when we get there. You want to make that journey to the place that God's showing us this morning? We can help you with that. If you're willing to turn your life over in faith to God like Abraham did and begin walking the journey, not just today, not just one momentary decision, but a lifetime commitment to walk the walk, no matter how God may test you and how God may tease a deeper faith out of you, we can help you with that. If you're willing to confess Jesus as the Son of God, repenting of your sins, your participation in the world, your desire to see life and live life the world's way, we'll baptize you for the forgiveness of those sins. Here's where you're a child of God already, but you have stumbled from the path that Abraham has walked before. So you want to get back on the journey of faith to the place that God has shown us, the place that God has taken us. We'll pray with you for you. Maybe you just need to do it yourself privately. Maybe you need to talk to those who are in your life to hold you accountable. Maybe you need the whole church to pray with you for this morning. But whatever is your need, your situation, why don't you talk to us right now while we stand, while we sing.
Number 326.